You are listening to The Adventures of Sariputta and Moggallana. I'm your host, Morris Sullivan. One day, while Sariputta was meditating, he realized that he was not going to live much longer. He decided he should go visit his mother one last time. His mother had never become a Buddhist, and you may remember from an earlier episode, she didn't really approve of Sariputta's life as a monk, either. However, he felt that she had untapped spiritual potential, so he called together a group of monks to go with him to visit her. When he arrived at the gate of the city where his mother lived, he sent a messenger ahead to ask her to prepare the room where he had grown up for him to stay in, and to plan for the other monks to stay at her home also. Sariputta had already become ill by the time he arrived at his mother's house. As he lay dying in his bed, deities began to arrive to visit him. A long string of devas and brahmas arrived to pay their respects to the Buddha's esteemed disciple. Finally, four Dharma kings came, accompanied by Sakka, the king of the gods, and the highest of the gods, Brahma. Seeing this, his astonished mother finally realized the importance of her son, whom she had abused so much in the past, over his decision to follow the Buddha's teachings. She realized that if Sariputta was so revered even by the gods, the Buddha himself must be very special. She asked Sariputta to tell her about his teacher. His response, even today, is chanted as part of the daily service at Theravada temples. He is blessed, worthy, and rightly self-awakened. Consummate in knowledge and conduct, he has traveled the path of goodness. He knows the cosmos and is the unexcelled trainer of those who can be trained, a teacher of humans and divine beings. By the time Sariputta had finished speaking, his mother had realized stream entry. After this, Sariputta's brother helped him sit up, and they called the monks together. Sariputta addressed them briefly, then lay down on his side and began to meditate. And on the day of the full moon in mid-autumn, he passed into nirvana. Today I'm going to talk about a couple of things that, as the Buddha's teaching spread out of northern India into the rest of the world and evolved, that became important. This is generally considered by most schools of Mahayana Buddhism to be the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. So the first turning of the wheel was the first talk that the Buddha gave early on, and he set out the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the teaching on not self and impermanence and those things. This is a little bit more evolved. And as Buddhism spread and it moved into China and places like that, the emphasis changed a little bit. More toward emptiness, the realization of emptiness, the development of compassion, and a thing we call bodhicitta, which is the mind of enlightenment. And I'll explain that a little bit more. So this sort of second turning of the wheel is said to have taken place at Vulture Peak, which is in a real place. It's in Rajgir in northern India. You can visit it. You can see where all these sutras you look at, it says, while residing at Vulture Peak, the Buddha said, and so you can go there. You could actually take a cable car to the top of the mountain. But the sutras that deal with this, for the most part, are probably not historical records. They're mythic in nature. So you can think of them as spiritual stories that encapsulate realizations that are congruent with, but expand on, these earlier classical teachings. So a lot of the time we think of religion as something that's sort of set in stone. Somebody says the holy words, and that's the way it is from now on. But that doesn't happen with any religion, and Buddhism is no different. And by the way, different schools of Buddhism will talk about this concept of the second turning of the wheel and the third turning and so on.
as different eras in Buddhist development from their perspective. So my choice of the term second turning and third turning, which I'll get to next time, are not universal, but these are the ones that I felt were useful ways of keeping these things straight in our minds. So I try, when I'm talking about these things, to speak not as a scholar or historian or Buddhist studies professor or any of that. I'm not qualified to do that. What I try to do is talk about these things in terms of how they'd be useful to you, how they can be useful to us in helping us end our stress, our suffering, our difficulties, and live lives that are freer and happier. If you want to delve into the details of, you know, what's known about the history and the infinite number of volumes that are incredibly technical and hard to read on, you know, how different schools interpret these things, you are welcome to do that. But you're not going to get that from me, because I don't find that interesting. What I find interesting is, how do I live a better life in a way that is going to make me happier and freer, spiritually freer? Kind of the first thing you need to know here is that as Buddhism spread out of India, the objective actually changed. So the Buddha talked about his practice in terms of becoming completely free from the cycle of coming and going. And you do that by becoming completely free of all attachments to anything, even to the idea of being unattached or non-attached. You basically stop fueling your existence altogether. But as Buddhism spread into China and elsewhere, it encountered other cultures, other ways of looking at things, and it was seen as that this arahant idea, this perfectly pure one ideal, was seen as a little selfish. You know, a society exists because we're cooperative and we support one another and so on. So why would you have a religion that says, no, I don't care about you, I'm just gonna get enlightened for my own good? Now, really, if you look at Theravada Buddhism, which is the closest that we come today to practicing the way the Buddha taught, you'll find it's actually implicit in what they do, that this is for the benefit of everyone. But they wanted to make it more explicit. And they said, we need a Buddhism that's for everybody, and where you don't have to be a monk to become enlightened or anything like that. We need a greater vehicle. So that's what Mahayana means, greater, great vehicle. We need a vehicle that's big enough to hold everyone. And so the ideal, the objective of practice became to be a bodhisattva. So you encounter this term bodhisattva in services. And it means Buddha to be, becoming a Buddha. So rather than being out of the cycle of coming and going altogether, now the idea is to stay in it a little bit so that you can help others. And eventually all beings will become awakened. And so that's the ideal, not just that I become freed from the cycle of stress, but that I become freed from the cycle of stress to the extent that I can bring you with me. You don't have to transcend every fetter. You can instead stay connected to existence, albeit probably a better one in most cases, in order to contribute to the enlightenment of all beings. And so this idea of bodhicitta, this is the mind of awakening, the resolve to awaken for the sake of all. And so now there becomes a little bit of a shift of emphasis just from liberation to compassion. Compassion is not like this is a new thing. Compassion is discussed in the Pali Canon, in the early teachings. And in fact, in our service here, we recite together the Metta Sutra. So, by the way, sutta as in Metta Sutta, and sutra as in Lotus Sutra and Heart Sutra are the same word in different languages. One's in Pali, one's in Sanskrit. as if Buddhism wasn't already confusing enough. But anyway, so, and the Pali teachings often talk about this idea of metta, which is the desire for others to be happy. So what does the Metta Sutra say you should do? Think, may all beings be happy and well. And then we recite that, may all beings be happy and well. We do that as a prayer. So this is the first of what's referred to as the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes. These are the highest mental dwelling states. If you want to be like the highest form of gods, you develop these. This idea actually predates Buddhism, by the way. Kind of existed in India already. The second one is Karuna, which is compassion, the desire for all beings to be free from suffering. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on the four Brahma Viharas today, maybe another time. But the third one is really gladness in the good fortune of others. It's recognition that if someone has something good, that that's a blessing. It's a result of their good actions in the past. And then equanimity, the ability to recognize that whatever happens is a result of causes and conditions. So it's the result of karma, and it's the ability to be stable in mind while you're living in a universe that is not stable. And so these teachings provide a lot of the basis for this later emphasis on compassion as a necessary element in wisdom. What does it, so emptiness is kind of the next big thing. This is one of these words that you start running into when you're reading about Buddhism, and it can be very confusing. The confusion is partly because the term emptiness is used in different ways to mean different but somewhat related concepts. It's difficult to grasp with the intellect. It's better to put it into practice than it is to try to explain it. That said, we have to try to explain it. During services, we chant a sutra that deals with emptiness, the Heart Sutra. So we call it the Heart Sutra for short. It's really the heart, the most important part of this collection of teachings called the Perfection of Great Wisdom. Maha means great. Pranya, which refers to profound wisdom. Paramita, Perfection Sutra. And there's this other word in there, Hridaya, which means heart. So that's what we chant. So it starts like this. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, doing deep pranya paramita, perfection of wisdom, perceived the emptiness of all five aggregates and was freed from suffering and troubles. Some translations say Avalokiteshvara was freed from fear. He realized emptiness, the emptiness of all five aggregates, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. And because of this realization, he was freed from all stress. He was freed from all concerns about stress. He was equanimous. Pranya wisdom is the deepest wisdom. It's the realization of emptiness. And so when you can realize emptiness in this later form of Buddhism, this second turning of the wheel, then that is awakening. Said, O Shariputra, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form, form is emptiness, emptiness form. Feeling, perceptions, cognitions, and consciousness are also like this. All things are expressions of emptiness, not born, not destroyed, not stained, not pure, neither waxing nor waning. So this is very poetic. It's also a little confusing. So last time I talked about the not-self characteristic. And I explained that the Buddha taught that what we identify with as us is really a set of processes, some of which have form, elements like earth and air and water and fire, combustion in the cells, energy, and some of which we can only refer to by name. So nama rupa, name and form. Avalokiteshvara then tells Sariputta, all things are expressions of emptiness, not just myself, but everything and everything that I see is an expression of emptiness. So, what does this mean? If I had a glass of water, I could pour out the water and I could say, this glass is empty of water. And you could say, yeah, but it's not empty because it's got air in it. So theoretically, you could suck all the air out of it and I could say, okay, well, now it's empty. But you could say, yeah, but it's got shape. You know, everything is empty to the extent that it's empty of something. One use of emptiness in Buddhism is as an approach to meditation. And in that sense, we're talking about the mind as being empty of disturbance. The Buddha explains this in a dialogue that he had with Ananda. Ananda, if you're new to this, was his cousin and a very close attendant. And he remembered a lot of what the Buddha said. He had a very, very good memory. And so a lot of our teachings that have survived because of Ananda. But anyway, he's staying in a monastery. And the Buddha starts out by saying that in this monastery, there are none of the disturbances associated with the village. So it's empty of elephants and crowds of people and people doing trade and all those kinds of things. The monastery is empty of those disturbances. And so a monk meditating there has only to contend with the lesser disturbances that come from living in a monastery. And then if he wants to, the monk can go out into the woods, which is empty of the disturbances associated with having other monks around and people coming to give alms and that kind of thing, and just dealing with the disturbance that arises in the wilderness. And by the way, that might not seem like much. You might think that meditating in the woods would be very peaceful. But I have a friend, a Thai monk, called Tan Rongson. And he spent a lot of time living in a forest monastery in Thailand. And he's a very serious meditator. He's one of these guys that will meditate all night and, you know, he falls asleep meditating at night and wakes up meditating in the morning and stuff like that. And he was telling me one time about being outside doing walking meditation. They build these huts out in the woods and they have these little walking paths and they pace back and forth doing walking meditation. And he said, I was doing that and I realized I was being watched by a tiger. He said, I could smell it. He said, I could tell by the smell that it was a big tiger, but I couldn't tell by the smell whether or not it was a hungry tiger. So he was afraid that if he ran, the tiger would chase him. But since the tiger was just watching him do walking meditation, he figured he'd just continue. And whatever happened would happen. There wouldn't be much he could do about it anyway. And so he emptied his mind of concerns about the tiger. So even though there was a tiger there, he was empty of disturbance about tigers. And he continued doing walking meditation until the tiger got bored and left. So in the wilderness, even a monk can empty himself of disturbances about the wilderness and concentrate just on the nature of earth, for example. And then the mind is empty of everything but disturbance related to the earth. And you can go on becoming empty of anything that arises, basically letting go of anything that comes into your awareness. And this is practicing emptiness as a form of meditation. That's not what Avalokiteshvara is talking about in the Heart Sutra, though. He's talking about emptiness as an attribute of existence. It says, the Bodhisattva was deeply absorbed in the penetration of understanding, and while he was meditating using his insight to discern the nature of reality, he observed the five aggregates and found them all equally empty, and doing this was freed of stress. He looked at form, feeling, perceptions, and consciousness and said, none of this is mine. It's all empty of that. And nothing else is inherently itself. It's only because of the meaning that we give things that they cause us stress. And as a result of that, he transcended suffering altogether. Because he was no longer clinging to this self or other self-existences, there was nothing else to worry about. Since things have no separate discrete self, then there is oneness. If something is not separate from other things, it must be interdependent with everything. So this is another kind of major thing that arises in Mahayana Buddhism. So consider this presentation book thing. So you look at it today and you see this notebook. There are a lot of different things that had to be in place before it could be here. For there to be paper here, there have to be trees. And the trees needed water and sunshine and all of that. There is a manufacturer. There is a distributor. There are trucks and truck drivers. The person who sold it to me. They're all in here. They all had to be in place before this could be here today. It also requires us and the engagement of our mind to make this what it is. To be what this is to me requires my perception of it and the mental formations that go along with it. So I see this, and to me, because this has our liturgy in it, you know, it's got the service that we use. So it's a good thing. It's a source of wisdom. Somebody else might see it as something boring, or someone might see it as something confusing. Somebody might even see this as evil. So for this book to exist, as we think of it as having existence, that also requires the mind. So this is interesting, but where does this stop being just kind of an amusing intellectual exercise and become actually useful? Well, one of my favorite Buddhist philosophers said something that I think is helpful. He said, we can measure our wisdom by the extent to which we can get ourselves to do things that we don't like to do, but that we know will lead to happiness, and to the extent that we can refrain from doing things that we like to do, but we know lead to harm. So why don't we follow that train of thought and see if this teaching on emptiness can help us do things that lead to happiness and stop doing things that lead to harm. So I mentioned interdependence. In essence, interdependence says that for one thing to be, something else has to also be. So you can't take the trees out of this. You can't take out the sun or the rain or all that kind of thing. The generations after generation of Buddhist teachers and so on. If you removed any of those things, this wouldn't be here, at least not in this form. So there's this realization when this is, that is. And when this ends, that it ends. Realizing this, that's awakening. So Avalokiteshvara realized suffering came from attaching to one's own selfness, and from thinking that other things had an inherent existence independent of us. And when that attachment ended, stress ended. And this is also where oneness comes in. We realize when we look carefully at what we think of as ours, that there's no separation between myself and other selves. And that realization requires us not just that we know what the Heart Sutra says, but that we live it, become one with it, and then armed with the wisdom of emptiness and realization of oneness, we can transcend much of our suffering. And when we do this, we start to understand that there is no difference between my suffering and my freedom, and the suffering and freedom of others. So our compassion frees us, while our compassion also frees others. So I know this is complicated. I say you have to practice with this. To walk out of here and say, Sensei Morris says, my compassion will free me and it will also free others, isn't going to do you a bit of good. You have to work with this. You have to let compassion transform you. And then you can realize the importance of this. With the understanding of emptiness, our mind of enlightenment, our desire to awaken for the benefit of all beings, actually becomes that awakening. Are you confused? Who's confused? Okay, good.
Good.
Put it to work. Right? Work with this idea of interdependence with all things. And as you work with it, don't just try to analyze it intellectually. If you do that, you'll mess up your head real bad. I'm kidding. You won't really. But if you try to practice it with your heart, then you'll start making some progress. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for listening to episode 43 of The Adventures of Sariputta and Moggallana. I'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 44 and more of the things that it's useful to know if you're going to practice Buddhism. Now go save the world.